Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the abuse excuse when we come back. You know, 3,000 years ago, before the science of meteorology was even thought of, Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes 1, verse 7, that all of the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. Well, every year, the continents and islands of the earth pour down into the oceans a stupendous volume of water. In fact, it's about 286,000 cubic miles of water flow into the oceans every year. Now, for century after century, millennium after millennium, this has been going on, and the sea has not increased its level by so much as an inch. Now, how is that possible? Well, we call it the cycle of evaporation and precipitation. And the writer of Ecclesiastes said that the ocean maintains its level in spite of this gigantic annual influx, because the rivers go back to the place from whence they came, and indeed they do. Every drop of rain that falls climbs back upon the Creator's elevator of evaporation to form themselves into clouds and then ride back to the head of their toboggan slide to begin their journey all over again. Now, in the modern science of meteorology, all of this is understood and its laws are comprehended. Modern science today has learned what the writer of Ecclesiastes knew 3,000 years ago. And that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Scripture. And it's one of the many lessons that we teach in our Mosaic Law School, conducted twice a year here at the Law School in Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, informative, and entertaining. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine, send us an email request for that free General Law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we've been reviewing the book called The Abuse Excuse. It's written by a college law professor, Harvard law professor. His name is Alan Dershowitz. Practices law before the Supreme Court. And he has some examples of abuse that go on. One of his examples was censorship. We've covered censorship now in the last two or three programs. And he's got another one here on page 103 that talks about the age excuse. The age excuse. It's an abuse, and typically when these abuses manifest themselves for a while, we get tired of it. And we want action. We're going to do something. Well, in the process of doing something, we typically overreact. And then the pendulum swings in the opposite direction, and we have another abuse, but it's an opposite abuse. Let me show you what happened here in California. Crime in California got pretty hot and heavy, or pretty much out of control, and somebody came up with a new concept, and they said, three strikes and you're out. Three strikes and you're out. So, you know, it sounds pretty good. You know, you like to give people an opportunity, you know, to to correct their errors in life. And so a guy goes out, and let's say he steals a car. And so we catch him, and then we prosecute him, and we put him in jail for 5 years, and we let him out, and we say that's once. And then a second case comes up, and he goes out and steals another car, let's say. And so we catch him, and then we punish him again, sentence him to 5 years, and we say that's twice. See? So the guy gets out of prison. So now the next time he goes out, and now he doesn't steal cars anymore. He hadn't been having a good experience with that. So now he goes out and sells drugs, which he learned that craft and trade while he was in prison in the jailhouse, you know, on the car theft program. And so now we catch him selling drugs, and so it's another felony. And so now we say, now that's three strikes and you're out. And so we lock this guy up for life imprisonment. By God, we're gonna rid the streets of a criminal. All right. Now there's an end that comes from that. There's a result that comes from that. Now, one of my old school buddies, you know, from years past, was a prison guard for many years there in California. And I was talking to him one day, and I said, Ed, what does it cost to lock somebody up in prison? Now, this is back in the 1970s. Well, this guy, Sirhan, they got locked up in Vacaville, cost at that time $35,000 a year. Probably in California today, it probably cost twice that, $70,000. Could cost more than that. There's one prison in the United States that it costs $425,000 a year to store one prisoner in that jail for 1 year. Did you people know that? Now, that's an exception. That's a federal pen, $425 a year. Now, I don't know what the average is nationwide, but I've got some numbers that come out. And typically the numbers from most prisons in the United States now run around to $50,000 a year. So it costs $50,000 now to store this guy in prison. Now, let's suppose this guy's 30 years old when we catch him the third time. Sometimes they catch these guys the third time when they're 21, but let's, you know, be reasonable. Now, assuming that this guy lives to be 75, we're going to keep this guy in prison for 45 years, right? Now, has anybody ever taken $50,000 a year and multiplied that times 45 years? So let's just take 50 times 45. And that's $2,250,000. $2.25 million to lock this guy up in prison for the rest of his life. Let me ask you this. The guy was out and he stole a car. And let's suppose it was a good car, a $50,000 car. Stole a Lexus. Second time he stole a Lexus, that was $100,000. Okay. Now he's out selling drugs. So, why is he selling drugs and stealing cars? Well, I suppose it's because he needs the money. Ain't it? I mean, if you're like me, you know, you need money to pay the rent. You know, to pay for the gasoline you're putting in your car. And so the guy's out selling drugs and he's out stealing cars. And we're gonna assume that this guy's stealing good cars now. Not like the average kid that's out here stealing, you know, an old used car somewhere. And most people, when they're stealing a car, remember stealing a used one. They're not stealing a new one now. Stealing a used car. Now, this guy, so far, he stole a $100,000 worth of cars. That's $100,000. And he was out selling drugs. Now, that didn't cost you and me a dime. That's zero. That's a victimless crime. Well, let's think about this. We've been convinced by our censors over here that we've got to have a war on drugs and we've got to solve this drug problem. Now, we're fighting a war in Afghanistan. And the reason we're fighting this war in Afghanistan is to protect the people of Afghanistan from the Taliban, whatever they call them. And these Taliban guys over here are bad guys. And they harbored Osama bin Laden, who allegedly knocked down our trade towers and killed 3,000 people, and so therefore we got to go to war. Okay, what's a given? I don't argue with it. Now, these Taliban guys are religious people, and they were opposed to the heroin growing of poppies in Afghanistan, so they stamped it out. And in the year 2000 and 2001 and 2, before we got involved in Afghanistan, we Americans over here were fighting a war on drugs. I mean, we're just deathly opposed to these drugs, heroin, marijuana, cocaine, crack, and so on. And so and we went over there and we threw the Taliban out. Now, what's happened in the 6 or 7 years since we threw the Taliban out? Well, the growing of heroin poppies in Afghanistan, which has always been big business there. It was big business when the British were over in India and Pakistan. Big business. And from the period of colonial Britain in India and Pakistan, they've been growing heroin over there in Afghanistan until the Taliban came in, these religious kooks. And they stamped it out. Just eliminated it. And they didn't have any Huey helicopters, and they didn't have sophisticated drug czars or anything like that, and lots of money. One of the poorest countries in the world is Afghanistan. And so they stamped out. Now, under the occupation, the American occupation, the poppy growing has increased. In fact, it has increased until the year 2006, they had the largest heroin poppy crop in the history of Afghanistan in the year 2006 under American occupation. Not amazing? It gets better. In the year 2007, they eclipsed the 2006 bumper crop and produced the largest crop of heroin in the history of Afghanistan in 2007. Now, the American authorities are working their hearts out trying to stop this heroin growing over there. They're just working night and day, struggling against the heroin growers. So in the year 2008, what do you think the poppy crop is like? Okay. If you thought that it was the biggest poppy crop in the history of Afghanistan, you're right again. 2008, as we close out the year here at this Yuletide season. The poppy crop in Afghanistan for 2008 eclipsed 2007, eclipsed 2006. Now remember, in 2003, they'd exterminated it, wiped it out. That's the Taliban, the bad guys. The good guys come in. And 3 years later, in the year 2006, biggest crop in history. 2007, bigger yet. 2008, bigger even yet. And we're working to stamp it out. Now, let me make a suggestion. If you'd like to stamp out heroin growing in Afghanistan, I mean, if that's your goal, you should throw the Americans out and put the Taliban back in, because they've already got a demonstrated history of being able to accomplish that goal, and the Americans have a demonstrated incapacity for controlling drugs. Now take a look at the drug border down here along the Mexican border, you know, where we're just working our hearts out and spending billions of dollars a year, have a drug czar in place to stamp out and eradicate drugs. In fact, there are so many drugs, so much cocaine coming across the border today that the marketplace for drugs is now at its lowest level in 20 years. I mean to tell you that cocaine and marijuana are selling at distressed bargain basement prices because there's so much of it. And that's because we Americans are just working so hard to stamp it out. Now, if you believe that, you got to have your head right square up the middle of your rectal region. I mean, you don't have to be real smart to figure out that the United States government promotes drugs and the drug trade through policy. Now, that's unpopular. See, if you go out here and you tell people, what we want to do is legalize marijuana, do you know what would happen to the price of marijuana? I mean, marijuana is easier to grow than tobacco, and you'd have marijuana cigarettes being sold out of vending machines for less than Marlboros. I mean, if you legalized it. To keep the price up, you have to make it illegal contraband, put people in jail, so that you can drive the price up. Now, if you want to know what the biggest single crop in America is, I mean here in America, would you say that it's cotton, wheat, soybeans, or corn? All right, now here's your four choices again. What is the biggest dollar value crop in the United States of America? Is it wheat, corn, soybeans, or cotton? Ding, 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 ding. You ready? You ready for this? No, it's marijuana. Marijuana sells $37 billion a year. Wheat, which is number two, is about $30 billion, and so on down the line. Now, I want you to understand that this marijuana being grown in the United States is being grown without any price supports, crop subsidies, or without chemical and commercial fertilizers and massive John Deere marijuana harvesting machines. I mean, it's all done by hand. The people that grow marijuana in this country do not have automatic discs and fertilizing machines and center pivot irrigation. I mean, these people have to carry the water out of a creek to water their plants by hand like they do in Africa. These people don't have any chemical fertilizers at all. They don't have any price supports or government set-aside programs or government price subsidy programs to keep the marijuana farmers from going broke like you wheat and corn farmers. They produce, in a totally free marketplace economy, they produce more dollar value out of their crop than the top four crops in America. Now, how do you like that? Well, I'll give you that little introduction over there because sometimes we get the wrong impression from government policy. See, the government says we want to stamp out drugs. No, they don't. Now, let's take this over to crime. Government comes along and says, we want to stamp out crime. No, they don't. Crime is a growth industry in this country. We buy crime in this country. And we're getting our money's worth. We are buying drugs in this country. Our government promotes drug consumption through policy. Now, they tell us over the news media that they're trying to stamp it out, but it grows every year. It gets bigger and bigger. Now, you know, come on, guys, let's wake up. Either one, these guys are incompetent and they need to be replaced because they can't accomplish the goal. Or two, they're lying to you and they don't want to stamp out drugs. Huh? Come on. All right, now let's take a look at crime here. Because in the abuse excuse, Alan Dershowitz has a story here on page 105. It's called The Age Excuse. Let's take a look at this. I'll read you his article and his position. And then we'll take a look at it. He starts off, he says, if Craig Price had been 2.5 weeks older, and if Craig Price had murdered the Heaton family in Oklahoma or in one of several other states, which authorized the imposition of capital punishment on 16-year-olds, he almost certainly would have been sentenced to death for his crimes. After all, he deliberately butchered 39-year-old Joan Heaton and her two daughters, Jennifer 10 and Melissa 8. Nor had this been his first killing. 2 years earlier, he had murdered another woman, and all of his victims were neighbors in the Buttonwood section of Warwick, Rhode Island. He also had a record of assaults, burglaries, and other assorted crimes. Craig Price, who was known as Iron Man to his football teammates, would have been a candidate for the death penalty, except for his age. You see, Craig Price fit the profile of those murderers who tend to receive the ultimate sentence. He is black, and his victims were white. and it is 10 times more likely in our still all too racist criminal justice system that a black man who kills white victims will be sentenced to death than a white man who kills black victims. His victims included children. They were local and came from good families. These are the kinds of factors that incline a sentencing judge or a jury toward the death penalty. Moreover, Craig had shown no remorse when he was apprehended and he confessed to the killings. There is nothing there. There is no emotion whatsoever, observed the arresting officer. You look at him and say, is he a psychopath? Now, after pleading guilty to the four murders, Craig Price smiled and told his friends, later, when I get out, I'm going to smoke a bomber, referring to a large marijuana cigarette. Now, Craig's friends will not have to wait very long for him to get out. You see, under Rhode Island law, later means 5 years for Craig Price. That means 1.25 years in a training school for each human being that he killed. By 1994, Craig and his friends will be smoking their bomber, and Craig's neighbors will have to get extra security for their homes. And that's because Craig Price was 2.5 weeks short of his 16th birthday, and this 240-pound youth had to be treated as a juvenile offender under Rhode Island law, and the maximum sentence for a juvenile, regardless of his crime or the number of people that he killed, is confinement in a training school until he turns 21. Then, when he reaches his 21st birthday, he must be released, regardless of whether he has been rehabilitated or merely turned into an even more dangerous adult criminal. Now, had Craig Price reached his 16th birthday at the time that he murdered the Heaton family, he could have received 3 consecutive life imprisonment terms. Rhode Island does not impose the death penalty, but the fact that he was 2.5 weeks short of legal adulthood makes all the difference in the world, because under Rhode Island law, between a relatively short term in a juvenile facility and spending the rest of one's natural life behind bars, in some states, a few weeks could make the difference between life and death. I'm going to put a bracket around that paragraph. Now, ironically, the Rhode Island legislature had considered and tabled legislation earlier in that year which would have allowed juveniles charged with murder to be tried as adults. I think I'll put a bracket around that one, too. The disparity in punishments illustrated in the Price case is not limited to Rhode Island or even to juveniles. Approximately 2,200 convicted murderers are now awaiting execution on death row in our several states, and following a judicially imposed moratorium on and near judicial abolition of capital punishment between 1967 and 1976, approximately 120 death sentences have been carried out. But during that same 13-year period, more than 250,000 homicides have been committed. A significant percentage of these killings could easily have been charged as first-degree murders, either premeditated or committed during the course of a felony. And the vast majority of those crimes were committed in states that authorized capital punishment. Thus, only an infinitesimal percentage of killers eligible for the death penalty are actually executed. I'm going to underline that. Thus, only an infinitesimal percentage of those that are eligible for the death penalty are actually executed. So what happens to the rest of these convicted killers? What happens to the vast majority of people who kill people and are convicted of murder? Well, a considerable number of these murderers plea bargain their way out of not only the death penalty, but also out of long prison terms. Others, who receive theoretically long prison terms, get out on parole after a relatively short time. Indeed, the average time spent in prison by a person convicted of homicide but not sentenced to death is 4 years. Okay, so I'm going to underline 4 years. In case you didn't know that, now you do. Now, even when we consider only those homicides that resulted in a murder conviction, the average is about 8 years. So it doesn't make any difference whether you go in and plead guilty or you plead not guilty and you are convicted for murder. On average, if you plea bargain it out, you'll serve 4 years, and if you're convicted, you'll spend 8. So if you'd like to save 4 years of your time, just plead guilty. And you'll spend half as much time in prison for murder. Now, this disparity fuels the argument in favor of retaining or even expanding capital punishment. If the only realistic alternatives are the death penalty or a few years in prison, then the case for the safer and more protective ultimate punishment takes on an understandable persuasiveness. And that is why, among other reasons, opponents of the death penalty should be outraged whenever a Craig Price or an older murderer receives an unjustly short term of confinement. Now, while we do not need capital punishment to protect us from murderers, we do need longer prison terms for murderers who pose a risk of recidivism. But even under, or even putting aside, practical arguments about protection, simple justice rebels at the idea of an admitted serial killer, whether he's 16 or 60 years old, serving only a little more than a year for each human life he deliberately snuffed out. All right, now let me back up here and we'll talk about this step by step. The age excuse is written into the laws of many states. You see, years ago, somebody woke up and they said, well, we don't think that we should take somebody who's under 16 years old and execute them for killing somebody. I don't know when that idea came up, but somewhere along the line it came up. Now, if you look in the Bible and you go back here into ancient times, go back to Moses, if you kill somebody, the penalty is death. Then it's death by stoning, and we're going to shed your blood. And there's no age mentioned. It doesn't make any difference if you're 9 years old or 90. You kill somebody, you die. See how simple that is? Now, there are some factors that do come in here. When does a person know that killing somebody is right and wrong? Well, I got to tell you that, for in my case, it came to my knowledge and my understanding at about age 5, maybe 6. It was before I went to school. Before I went to school, I knew that stealing was wrong and that killing people was wrong. That was explained to me by my parents. Just as a little take. So by age 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, you know, I knew that murder was wrong. Even though I went to the murders and I saw people being killed. I saw it in the movies. I saw people being killed in the movies. And I knew, oh my God, that's wrong. Why are those people doing that? Why are they killing people? Don't they know that's wrong? You know, even as a child, I knew that. Now, here in America, we used to teach children the Ten Commandments. And one of the Ten Commandments says, you shall do no murder. Thou shalt not steal. You know, thou shalt not commit adultery. Crazy things like that. And so, the children, when I was a youngster growing up, knew that adultery was wrong, murder was wrong, theft was wrong, covetousness was wrong, idolatry, Sabbath prayer. You see, we all knew that those were wrong actions. Now, today we don't teach the Ten Commandments in school or in church. The Ten Commandments have been banned in American society. We don't practice the Ten Commandments. We don't teach the Ten Commandments. We don't observe the Ten Commandments. And so as a result of that, we have crime. And somebody's going to write me a letter now and say, but you can't prove that. Well, I can report it. I don't have some duty to prove to you that that's true or false. I just have a duty to report it to you. Now I reported it. Now the guy that told us this is the creator of the universe. This guy that we call God, you know, he came up to a conclusion. He said, now listen, if somebody goes out and kills somebody, then we need to kill them. And we kill them in a public execution. You take them out and you tie them up to a telephone pole, and you bring a dump truck in and you dump some rocks in the street and you make everybody pick up a rock and throw one rock at this guy. It's a public execution. It isn't done in secret back here in prison someplace. We don't lock this guy up for 5 years in jail. We don't have any penitentiaries. And we got this law from Moses. And in fact, if you have a child that's out of control and you can't control this child, and in this case, the parents of this 16-year-old kid who was out here killing people, under the Mosaic law, we would go to the parents of this 16-year-old kid. And we would take his parents, and we would stone the 16-year-old kid, and we would stone his parents right along with him. That's what the law of Moses requires. Now, Mr. Dershowitz is opposed to the death penalty. He doesn't want the death penalty put on there at all. The people of Rhode Island, they don't want the death penalty. They want to lock people up in prison, which is why I brought to your attention the cost of locking somebody up in prison for the rest of his life, which we'll talk more about when we come back. Meanwhile, let me remind you that you are listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. However, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about a book. I'm reviewing a book, and it's called The Abuse Excuse, and it's written by Alan Dershowitz. I recommend it highly. I call it a 1 in 100. I never read anything like it before. I think this guy is essentially correct. Now, this is one of the exceptions to the rule. But I'm not taking exception with his conclusion. I'm taking exception with his line of reasoning. Now, his facts are essentially correct. Remember, he said that blacks who kill whites are 10 times more likely to be executed for the crime than a white man who kills a black person. And he says that's an abuse. He's exactly right, that is. God never made any exceptions for blacks killing whites or whites killing blacks. So Mr. Dershowitz comes to a conclusion. He says, now, what we need to do is to abolish the death penalty. So in Rhode Island, they did. They abolished the death penalty. Period. And then he reports to us that, on average, if you kill somebody and you walk into the police and say, hey, I confess, I killed that guy, the average penalty that you're going to pay is 4 years in jail. Now, I fail to see the logic here in Mr. Dershowitz's argument. He says this kid who is 16 years old is going to serve about 1 year in jail for each person he killed. And he says that that is too short a confinement. Well, and Mr. Dershowitz, can you tell me what is the correct confinement? Should it be 5 years for each person you kill? 10 years? 20 years? 30 years? I don't know. You tell us. It's your argument. Go make it. I don't know how long the confinement should be. I couldn't tell you. I don't know what the solution is of and by myself, but I did read about one. Now, there's a guy out here called God. And in the scripture, he's the guy who created us, and he said, now, I'm telling you, let me tell you, don't run around killing people. They're my creation. I don't want you, just because you have the power to go out and kill somebody, does not give you the right to do that. So I'm going to take that right away from you. Now, God kills people all the time. This God, this Creator, oh my God, you read the Bible, it's just full of just story after story after story where this guy kills people. Let me give you an illustration. There was a place called Sodom and Gomorrah. And God told these people, he said, now, I don't want you people to practice sodomy. That's a perverted sexual practice. And these people didn't listen, and so they went out and did it. So he brought fire and brimstone down on these two cities. Actually, there's five towns there in this valley, and you read the story, there's five places he destroyed, but most people only know about Sodom and Gomorrah. He killed them all. Josephus said it was around 100,000 people. So for this guy, this God over here, to kill 100,000 people is commonplace. Which is why my granny said the Bible is just full of violence, and she hated it. My grandmother just absolutely hated the Bible. She hated God. She wouldn't have anything to do with it. She called it pornographic, filthy, perverted, perverse, violent. All right. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, irrespective of your view of the scriptures, this guy in here says, now there's a solution to the crime problem. And so, and here's Dershowitz comes along and says, my God, this kid's 16 years old. If he was 2.5 weeks older, we could have executed him. Well, not in Rhode Island, because they've abolished execution. So what we're going to do in Rhode Island is lock him up for the rest of his life. Now, I don't know what the price was in 1990, but today it's about $50,000 a year. So let's take a kid 16 years old and let's lock him up for life, and he's going to die at age 75. So how old is he going to be? We're going to lock him up for about 60 years. So if we lock this Price kid up for 60 years times, now get this, $50,000 a year, you know, $50,000, that's $3 million. Let me ask you this. You got a guy here who goes out and kills people, and he so terrifies you that you say, we've got to lock him up for the rest of his life. Why would you want to sentence yourself to a $3 million fine to protect yourself from from a danger that you can readily see exists. In other words, you see this danger. You know, maybe there's a danger in not buckling your seatbelt. And so you don't buckle your seatbelt, the policeman catches you, and he locks you up in prison for the rest of your life because you didn't appreciate this danger. Why would those of us in society want to spend $3 million to lock a guy up for not buckling his seatbelt because he didn't appreciate the danger that's involved in it? And so you say to yourself, well, my God, that's crazy. I agree. I think it's crazy. I wouldn't want to lock somebody up for 60 years in prison for not buckling his seatbelt or buckling the seatbelt of his kid or putting his kid into a child restraint. Now, let's suppose that happens. Here's Mama. She gets in the car. She doesn't put her kid in a child restraint. She gets in an accident. And the kid is killed. Do we say, oh my God, it's your fault your child died. If your child had been in that child's seat, he wouldn't have been killed. Therefore, we're going to lock you up in jail, Mother, for 60 years. We don't do that. I've never heard of that being done. And you'd say, well, that's crazy. That's disproportionate. Yeah, I agree with that. So Dershowitz says, look at this abuse excuse. We say that because this kid isn't 16 years old, there's nothing we can do. We're going to lock him up for 5 years and then turn him loose. And he says, that's crazy. Gee, Mr. Dershowitz, welcome to reality. I think it's crazy too. I didn't write this law. Had we followed the law of God, the Creator, we'd take this 16-year-old kid out and we would stone him to death. We'd kill him, which would save us about $2.5 to $3 million. Furthermore, we would protect ourselves from the deprivations of this kid going out and killing somebody again, which he more than likely either has done or is probably going to do again. Furthermore, under the biblical law, we would have taken his parents out and stoned them to death. Now, what would happen if every time we had a 16-year-old kid, a gang killer, down here on the streets of Los Angeles, and he's shooting people off the street corners, and we catch this kid, and he's 15 years old, he's 13 years old, he's 15. We take him out and we stone him to death. Each and every time we catch a juvenile killing somebody, we stone him to death, but we take his parents out and stone them also. How long do you think that this juvenile gang violence would go on? How long do you think that would last? Well, it would last until we ran out of delinquent parents and delinquent children. Now, they are a distinct minority in our society. If you were to take a look at 300 million Americans, and how many of these 300 million Americans are involved in gang violence, the answer is not very many. A few thousand at best. Now, the reason for the death penalty, Mr. Dershowitz, just in case you didn't understand how this thing is, it's for the purpose of deterrence. But you say, but it doesn't deter. And you're exactly right, Mr. Dershowitz. The death penalty, as it's being applied in America today, does not deter anybody from killing people. That's because we have this abuse excuse. You see, we say, well, we shouldn't be killing the parents because of what the kid does. But God Almighty, the Creator, says, yes, you should. You should. Because if this kid had been taught, thou shalt not kill, at an early age, he probably wouldn't do that. Now, I want to report to you that I'm nearly 70 years old. I have not killed anybody yet. I didn't even join the army and go out and kill people legally. It's against the law to do that. I'm not a pacifist. And I've got a gun, and sometimes I shoot it. I'm not opposed to guns. I'm not in favor of gun control at all. I'm one of those that thinks that people kill, guns don't. Now, most people, you know, they say, well, we got to abolish guns. Why? Because most people kill other people with guns. Hell, if they didn't have a gun, they'd do it with a knife. They'd do it with a car. They would poison them to death. I mean, you know, when people want to kill somebody, they go out and do it. It is true that guns are easy to kill people with, and it's probably true that 16-year-old kids out on the streets of Los Angeles ought not to have guns because they haven't been taught how to use them. But let me back up a minute. I received my very first gun when I was 11 years old. 11. And my daddy gave me a .22 bolt action rifle. And then he proceeded to take me out and teach me how to shoot it and clean it and load it and unload it and use it and to avoid killing other people with it. And I want to report to you that he was 100% successful. My friend David Wagner had a gun when he was 12 years old. And my friend Ed O'Neill, he had a gun when he was 12 years old. You see, when I was 12 years old, nearly every kid that I knew, I don't know of anyone that didn't have a gun. Let me put it to you that way. There may have been, when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 years old, there may have been some people my age who did not have a gun. But if there were, I didn't know any of them. Now, today, you people are sitting out there saying, oh, my God, you mean you'd trust a 14-year-old kid with a gun? Why not? But 14-year-old kids on the streets of Los Angeles have not been taught by their parents how to use a gun. And so they learn how to use guns out on the streets from their friends. I don't think that 14-year-old kids should be learning how to use a gun from another 14, 15, 16-year-old kid. I don't think that's good public policy. I think that 12-year-old boys and girls should learn how to use a gun when they're about 12 years old, maybe 11, maybe even 10. I have a grandson. The other day I took him down to the valley. He's about 8 years old. And I took him down there with a gun. And we did a little target shooting with a .22. He's 8 years old. I think that's a good time to start him. I wouldn't give him the gun. I wouldn't let him go out by himself. He's not ready for that yet. But by the time I was 12 years old, I would take my gun and I would go down and get on the ferry and I would drive, or I mean, I'd take the ferry over to Samoa and I would use my gun and shoot birds and shoot targets and cans and bottles. And so I learned how to use it, and I never killed anybody, and neither did any of my friends. But today we have a problem with these children. They're out killing people. And it's because their parents aren't teaching them. When I was a kid, they taught us. We had education. Today we don't. And so you have gang violence. Now, those parents who brought those children into the world have a duty. They have a responsibility. And they have foisted that responsibility off onto society. We call it public school. And so they want the public schools to teach them. Now, the people in public schools don't want to teach these children how to use a gun. They don't want to teach these children the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill. They deplore the crimes. They deplore the outcome that comes from this lack of education, but they don't want to do it themselves. The parents don't want to educate the child. That's an abuse. They want to foist it off on the public school. The public school doesn't want to teach the Ten Commandments. They don't want to teach gun safety. Now, they don't want to impose the death penalty. Well, okay, there's an outcome that comes from all of this action or lack of it. Now, I'm in favor of the death penalty, and I'm in favor of it because the creator of the universe, who's smarter than I am, said that locking people up for 10, 20, or 30 years isn't the solution. In fact, if you look in the scripture, there is no provisions whatsoever for incarceration. There is no provision for doing penance, which is what a penitentiary is. It's for the purpose of doing penance. God isn't religious. He's a pragmatist. And he said people that go out and kill people, no matter what their age, need to be killed. And if they're underage, then their parents need to be killed with them. Now, there's a procedure you go through. Let's suppose you're a parent. And I would imagine that the parents of this child, this young hoodlum, could probably recognize that he was out of control by the time he was about 14 years old. Remember, the report says he was already in trouble with the law. Before he was killing people, he was already in trouble with the law. Therefore, he was already out of control. Now, in the Bible, God requires that the parents maintain control of their child. Now, we require that in our society today. Even Mr. Dershowitz would require me to keep my dog under control. If I had a dog and my dog was out biting people, Mr. Dershowitz would say, "Well, my God, Mr. Gordon, you didn't keep your dog under control. We need to punish you, Mr. Gordon, because you failed to keep your dog under control. You didn't keep him on a leash, and he bit this kid over here." And you know, Mr. Dershowitz, you're exactly right. I agree with you. I think if I fail to keep my dog under control, I ought to be responsible for my dog's misbehavior. But somehow or another, we jump the tracks of sanity. If we've got a kid, and this kid is out of control, and he's going around shooting people, parents shouldn't be responsible for their children killing people. Excuse me? Huh? What in the hell is going on here? You mean you brought this child into existence, mothers and daddies, but you're not responsible for his education and his behavior? Well, the creator of the universe thought you were, and he charged you with that duty. So if you've got a child that's out of control, you take him to the authorities and you say, "This, our son, is out of control. He won't mind us. And we don't want to be responsible for his actions. We don't want to be responsible for this, for what this guy's going to do. And so we want you to take him out and stone him to death." And so the parents have the power of life and death over their children. Not in society today, but under the law of God, under the Mosaic law, under the Ten Commandments. Under the Ten Commandment model, the parents have the power of life and death. And so the parents don't kill this child. The parents take him to the authorities. And then the authorities make a determination, and then they take the child out, and then the parents cast the first stone, and then the rest of us kill this kid. Not because he's killed anybody, but because he's in violation of the fifth commandment. You shall honor your father and mother. And the death penalty is prescribed for children who do not obey their parents. All right, now let's test this. I've got a dog out here, and this dog is decidedly dangerous. But I don't tie him up, and I don't do anything with him, and you come to visit me, and my dog runs over and bites you. And in due course of time, you sue me, and you're going to win because I didn't restrain my dog. Now, if I have a dog and I know that this dog is dangerous, and you'll see this in Exodus chapter 21, verses 28 through 36, and they use a bull as an example, and I got this bull out here, dog or whatever, and he's dangerous, and I don't restrain him, and he causes you a damage. If this bull were to kill you, then the penalty is I'm to be put to death. So the logical thing for me to do is to put my dog down. I take him to the vet and I say, "Hey, I got to kill this dog because this dog is dangerous. I've got to kill this bull." I send him off to the butcher because this bull is dangerous. And I do that because the animal is mine and it's my responsibility. And that's what Mr. Dershowitz is pointing out here. We need responsibility. But he's opposed to the death penalty. Well, I'm opposed to the death penalty also, but opposed to it the way it's being imposed. It's not being imposed correctly. If we would follow the instructions from the Scripture, we would find that the death penalty would reduce murder. It would reduce these violent crimes. How do I know that? The Creator of the universe told me. And then my common sense comes into play, because here's the way we would do this. You can rest assured, boys and girls, the very first mother and father executed in a public square in Los Angeles, California, with their 14-year-old teenage hooligan gang member child, would send a message to every other parent in the community that says, oh my God, if my kid were to go out and shoot somebody off the street corner, I could be killed. I could be executed for what my kid does, in the same way that I could be punished for what my dog does or what my bull does. Do you think that that would have a positive impact upon juvenile delinquency? Well, let me tell you, the creator of the universe thought so and instructed us to do that and gave us a law to back it up. He said, you shall honor your father and mother. And if you don't honor your father and mother, then the death penalty ensues. So when you've got a kid, you know, that's 14 years old, and you say, kid, come here, and he won't come. And you say, kid, sit down, and he won't sit. I mean, you know, most of you people, if you had a dog, and you said, come, sit, speak, fetch, and he wouldn't do that, you would insist, you would spend money to have that dog trained. But not your kid. Now, it occurs to me that a 14-year-old child is more valuable than a dog, and that we ought to spend more time, effort, and energy training our children, especially training them to the Ten Commandments. And I think we'd have a whole lot less crime. Now, Mr. Dershowitz over here said, had Price reached his 16th birthday at the time that he murdered the Heaton family, he could have received 3 consecutive terms of life imprisonment. Yes, yes, if he'd have been 2.5 weeks older, we could have sentenced ourselves to a $2.5 million fine because we couldn't obey God and keep His commandments and stone that punk to death. And I'm sitting here saying, why in the hell do we want to spend billions? Now, we're spending about $50 billion a year on prison. I think that's the number I saw the other day, $50 billion a year. What in the hell is it in our interest to spend $50 billion a year because we can't carry out the death penalty, for crying out loud? Because we can't practice the Ten Commandment model? We can train our dogs, but we can't train our children? Is that the message that we're getting here? Huh? All right. Now, we're not going to practice the fifth commandment, and we're not going to practice thou shalt not kill, but we're going to continue to have more and more crime, and we're going to pay more and more taxes to lock more and more people up for longer and longer periods of time, which doesn't make any sense and doesn't solve the problem, and it just punishes us even more. The guy goes out and steals our car, and instead of punishing the thief by making him pay for the car, no, we lock him up in prison. He doesn't have to pay a dime, and then we have to pay to store him in there $50,000 a year. What in the hell kind of sense does it make? The guy steals one car. Boys and girls, you could give this prisoner that you've got locked up for life in prison $1 million and save yourself $1.5 million. Why don't you just take every criminal that's locked up for life in prison, give him $1 million and turn him loose? You would save money. Now he doesn't need to steal anymore. He's got money. I mean, come on, let's use our heads. Don't you think? I'm out of time here again, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there. You've been listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. Remember, the book now is called The Abuse Excuse by Alan Dershowitz. You need a copy. Let me tell you. You need a copy. So, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.